We're listening back to some of our favorite archives of the Mark Steiner Show today. First, we hear my 2009 conversation with author James McBride about his book, Song Yet Sung. Enjoy. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are, in this next hour, going to be talking with James McBride, whose latest novel, Song Yet Sung, takes place in Maryland, but is also the book, One Maryland, One Book, and people across the state are reading this book. It's one of your first opportunities here in the state of Maryland to hear a conversation with him. Of course, he also wrote The Color of Water and Miracle at Santa Ana. And James McBride, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's an amazing book. It's about our state, obviously, the Eastern Shore, which was really also just pretty amazing. But I want to talk about how you came to this book. I mean, just for our listeners who have not yet read the book, I mean, it takes place during slavery on the Eastern Shore about a woman who's deeply mystical, who is the struggle over going to freedom and how you get to freedom, the complexities of white and black in all of that. So I'm curious, talk about your sojourn to this book.
Well, I was, I'd wanted to write about the Civil War and slavery, but I couldn't figure out a good way to do it without, I just got stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took a drive down to, down on State Route 50 near Cambridge, and I saw a sign that said the birthplace of Harriet Tubman was nearby.
Oh, yes, right.
So I just I drove my little, you know, I have a little old 1991 Volvo.
Do you?
I still drive it.
That's good, man. That's good.
And I drove around to this, I followed the signs, and I came to a cornfield. And there was a little sign there, and I just stood around for a while, and I just started to wonder about her, basically, and how they managed, how she managed to move some 300 odd people up through the Eastern Shore during slavery time. But I was also intrigued about, I mean, the Eastern Shore is a very interesting place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you drive into the Eastern Shore, into the backwood areas of it, or the back areas of it, it's pretty much now as it was, you know, 100, 200 years ago.
In more ways than one.
Well, I don't know if it's. Fortunately, I didn't have that. I didn't have any experiences like that when I was down there. I had a pretty good, you know, pretty good time. I think people make choices about how they want to live based on criteria that sometimes I might not agree with. So mm-hmm. I'm pretty open-minded when I deal with people. And so I didn't have to. I had a little bit of trouble with the Eastern. I say Eastern County Historical Society, they were a little bit.
Yes, Eastern Maryland, yep.
Yeah, they were not that useful. I went in there to get to try to find the map, and the lady just basically told me to go to the library and basically just told me to get out. But other than that, I didn't have much trouble down there.
Mm-hmm. So here we are on the Eastern Shore, what was your discovery process about Harriet Tubman once you were standing in that field?
Well, I was amazed at how smart she must have been,
mm-hmm.
because you know the Eastern Shore has no mountains. There are no real hills.
Right.
You know, there's just it's all flat. It's all swampland. It's all you have to kind of know the water to move around. And I began to imagine what it must have been like for her. I started reading some books. I started talking to some of the local, you know, quote-unquote local people, and it became clear to me after a while that there was during slavery time, there must have been some kind of mass, silent movement to get these people moving from the Eastern Shore to Delaware and Philadelphia, which was basically the Freedom Line. And how they did it clearly was some sophisticated business and using the water and watermen. And, you know, so I started to investigate watermen and how watermen lived and who they were and so forth. And they were fascinating. They were and are, you know, a fascinating group of Americans, both black and white watermen, the people who worked on this, you know, who tongued for oysters off the Eastern Shore in the Chesapeake.
Well, you said something about the waterman there that I never thought of, that I'm very intrigued by, the way you described the culture of the waterman in the 19th century as a group of people who really, if they weren't anti-slavery, they clearly weren't pro-slavery. They're the culture being different than the plantation owner's culture, which is a revelation to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a fellow by the name of Thomas Flowers who was a city councilman or council. He was from Hooper Island, I believe they call it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and
that's
he wrote
right.
a couple of unpublished books about waterman's life. There's also a guy named Fred Tilp who wrote a couple of books that were published by Tidewater Press, I believe it's called, about the life of watermen. There's lots of books about watermen that you can find down on the Eastern Shore. You can't find them anywhere else. But they were a group up in, you know, pretty much unto themselves because they lived off the bay.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like cowboys, except they were tougher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at the Wild West, you know, the mythical creatures of cowboys, who are kind of the mythological American heroes there, these tough guys who drink hard and, you know, they were out on the prairie and they fought off Indians and, you know, the women were all clean and they all looked good and so forth. You know, the watermen weren't like that. You know, they were tough men and women who fished in the winter and farmed during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very independent. All the way until the Annapolis Bridge was built, the watermen kind of stood alone. They didn't like outsiders. You know, they were people from Hooper's Island, for example, when they went to Cambridge, you know. It would kick tail between Cambridge and Hooper's Island just because they were, you know, they had that territorial sense of this is who we are.
And that's what you did, and you weren't afraid to fight.
Well, no, I mean, you wouldn't find me tangling with any of them. But then they were deeply religious,
mm-hmm.
And they were, you know, they really were profoundly religious, and they were deeply affected by a fellow by the name of, I believe his name was Reverend Adam Wallace. He was a minister who traveled around the Eastern Shore by boat preaching, because some of them didn't have churches. If they had churches, the minister would visit, and he visited this parish and that parish. And he began to preach about the evils of slavery during the 1820s and 30s, and that had a profound effect on the watermen. Watermen were very religious because they, you know, God was a big deal to them,
mm-hmm.
for the obvious reason that they, you know, they understood the power and majesty of God because they were on the bay all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they understood how quickly a life could get washed away if you were out in the water and a storm came up quickly and so forth. So this one minister's preachings during that period started to kind of have a pretty profound effect on a lot of the watermen. They never were that – they were never crazy about the rich – timber owners and plantation owners that lived on the Eastern Shore, partly because the plantation owners were basically rich people. When I say plantation owners, the plantation owners on the Eastern Shore were more dealt in timber, big oystering boats, and tobacco rather than cotton.
Right, not so much cotton. Right.
Yeah. So they weren't that fond of the rich folks either, and they weren't that fond of slavery, partly because slavery meant free labor, so that when they wanted to do they wanted to get a job, they were competing with slaves who didn't have to get paid, whose masters would get paid a smaller fee than they, meaning the watermen, would be paid. So they weren't that fond of slaves or slave owners. They were pretty much an independent body.
So one of the things that runs through this book, and as an aside, the watermen made me think about Appalachian culture in terms of their anti-slavery position, which I never thought about with the watermen, But one of the things that you delve in so deeply that few have touched on in books about the period of slavery in American history is the complexity of race, even during the time of slavery. It wasn't simply just black and white. I support slavery. I'm against slavery. I'm a slave. You're not. The nuances of society were as deep then as they are now.
Well, you know, that's really the story.
Right.
And then we're living that now with, you know, the current administration of Barack Obama and all of this, you know, the bickering and the kind of, you know, hooliganism that's going on with regard to the deliberation about health care. Part of the problem is that during slavery was that it was a complicated problem for the Eastern Shore because the Eastern Shore stood right near the free Freedom Line. You know, you could, once you hit Annapolis, you were only 80 miles away from Philadelphia. And it was known to blacks in the South that if you could get up to this part of that, meaning the Eastern Shore, up to this part of America, you had a shot at getting free.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one problem. The other problem was that Eastern Shore, many white people were ambivalent about slavery. Most white people didn't own slaves. And so, you know, what let slavery live was this whole business of racism and white superiority and so on and so forth. Now, that's easy to say, and that's easy to implement as a policy. But when you own one or two slaves, which down on the Eastern Shore, most people own slaves, only own one or two or a family, and they become part of your family. They become part of your life. Selling one of them off is not as easy as it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, for example, Kathleen Sullivan is a good example.
Right.
You know, she owns these three slaves. She needs to sell them because she lost her husband on the Chesapeake. Her husband was a waterman. He died, and his slave died with him on their boat. So now she has three slaves left. She has to sell one of them, otherwise she's going to lose her farm. She can't bring herself to do it. She's starting to have doubts about slavery. These kinds of things, these are the kinds of feelings that led up to the Civil War that were becoming more and more apparent that this whole business of owning human chattel was not really working out that well. And so people were not always happy about the business of slavery. And so people had various feelings about it. Yet the economic business of it had to move forward because slavery was economic business. So it was the great unspoken problem that never seemed to be able to be resolved easily.
It's rare that someone can describe or write about what you just spoke about, which is the intimate, intense relationship between some owners and slaves. That, I mean, slavery was horrendous, and it was the most horrific, horrible thing that happened to people, I think, in our history. But that, again, it's that complexity of those relationships, especially on the Kathleen Sullivan level. Or even with Denwood, the slave catcher, who had his own doubts about what he did for a living.
Well, I mean, that's Denwood. It was he was a great character.
He was a great character,
partly because he was a waterman, and partly because he worked as a slave catcher, and he was the best slave catcher that had been on the Eastern Shore for years. And then he retired, and then he comes back to take this one last job. The complexity of the relationships between black and white really is why I wanted to write about slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the stereotypical view of it was that it was, you know, the master has a whip and he's whipping the poor slave and the slave is saying, oh, please. It, you know, that's not really, yeah, that happened, but a lot of other stuff happened too.
Mm-hmm.
There was a reason why this business lasted for 400 years other than just out-and-out racism. There was a certain comfort level that, you know, if you owned a slave, you had to feed that person. You had to feed, clothe, and house that person. You had to fill him, not only him or her, not only with the sense of that you were superior, but you also had to give them a sense of safety and a sense of comfort and so on and so forth. And some people like that. Now, that's not to say that I would have liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm speaking for people who are no longer here. But listen, if you work at the post office long enough, you feel like you're a kind of slave. Not that the post office is bad for those who work at the post office.
Right. I mean, it helped build the middle class in America. Right.
I don't want to set off any post office, you know. Like,
yeah.
But, you know, things are the way they are. And what happens is humans adapt and develop relationships that simply cross the legal boundaries that we set up. So, you know, you had slaves who fell in love with their masters, and you had masters who fell in love with their slaves, and you can't really legalize how people feel.
Right.
And ultimately, the humanity of your subject, the humanity of human beings' feelings for each other will eventually either come forth or they won't. But even during slavery time, as complicated as relations are between blacks and whites now, they were as complicated then as they are now. The only difference was that whites had the absolute last word most of the time, but slaves were very clever about manipulating their masters and manipulating society into moving things in their direction. That's not to say that I'm not saying slavery was good. I'm just saying
people like
pets understand how to manipulate the master at certain points.
Well, as you're describing it, it made me think of that whole idea of people who owned slaves were like may have fallen in love with people who they held as they fell in love with their dog or fell in love with some other.
Yeah, well, that's not something that black people like to hear.
No, but I'm just saying that's part of the reality, I think, as well.
Yeah, listen, that's true. The true reality of all of it is that slavery made slaves of us all.
Yes.
It made slaves of the slave master and the slave himself. Frederick Douglass wrote that with just profound clarity.
He did.
And that's why Denwood is such an interesting character. Because he's a person who slaves know him, and they know that if they're running away and he's chasing somebody else, if they're running away and they run into him, he's not going to bother them. He just wants the one person that he's being paid to catch. So there's a certain amount of trust between Denwood, the slave catcher, and the slaves he's chasing. There's a certain amount of respect. They might not like each other, but Denwood knows that slaves who can abscond, who can get free and get 10 or 15 or 20 miles away from the master, are pretty smart. Because slaves who ran away and escaped had to be, most slaves were caught. The ones who got away were really smart and usually physically and mentally extraordinarily tough. And that's why you needed a man who was physically and mentally extraordinarily tough to catch these people. But if he was not getting paid to catch you and you ran up against him, he wouldn't bother you. So he had the respect of blacks who knew him. And most blacks did know him. Blacks knew who the slave catchers were. They knew, they knew who the people whose, if your life was involved, if your freedom was involved, you know who's the guy whose job it is to catch you. You know him well, and you talk about him amongst each other and so forth. So that's what makes him an interesting character in the book.
I didn't know where I was going to go with Denwood, but I'm obviously at the end of the book. We won't talk about that, but I was just very taken with his character, with all these characters, really. I mean, for most of them you can find an empathetic core to. But before I come to that, because I want to talk about Patty Cannon and Liz Sprockett, which are two seminal figures who I think were both based on real human beings. But I want to go somewhere else first. The another subtext in this book, is the slave underground, the move to freedom underground, the code that many historians say didn't exist, and some say did exist, and clearly for you it existed, and it was a powerful piece of the story. So talk about that.
Well, first of all, well, the historians that say that when I was talking about the codes, the Underground Railroad, which was called the Gospel Train by many black slaves, historians say that there were no set of signals that blacks used, and the Underground Railroad code didn't really exist.
Right.
I don't believe that.
I don't either.
That a code exists. First of all, as a musician, I can tell you when I went to Oberlin Conservatory and learned African American music, some of the first things that the professor started talking about was how these songs were used during slavery, so that when slaves were running, if someone was singing a certain song, these songs had meaning.
And this is
clear as day. I mean, wade in the water meant to you wade in the water. The dogs couldn't sniff in the water. We will break bread together on our knees, Getaway Jordan. All of these songs were used by slaves to either discuss their condition or to warn those who were hiding in the woods nearby whether it was time to go, lay low, move, and so forth. And Harriet Tubman, in two or three biographies written about Harriet Tubman, they talk pretty clearly about how she used songs as signals to tell people who that she was leading the freedom, that it was time to go, it was time to wait, and so forth. In terms of some of the other business, the quilts,
mm-hmm.
the hand signs, I believe that a lot of this stuff was used. Now, it might not have been used in South. I mean, you might have seen different signs in, Dorchester County that you didn't see in Columbia, South Carolina. But I'm convinced that there was a lot of signaling and code work that went on in plain sight. So I use that in the book because whites were very cognizant, especially on the Eastern Shore, they were very cognizant, especially as you got close to the Civil War, that slaves were trying to get away.
Mm-hmm.
And And so they will. They would watch their slaves. I mean, if you pay $1,200 for a guy, which was, you know, I don't know what that would be in today's dollars, but it would be, I don't know,
five figures at least, right?
You know, you'd watch that guy, and if he was young and he had a chance to spawn and make more slaves for you, you're watching him, and if he takes off, you might be hung up bad. So you're watching him close, and so what blacks did was they just developed a set of codes that would allow them to speak to each other, to let know that this one is hiding or that one's moving or I got two here, I'm trying to move them. And if you spoke out against this, if you gave it away, if you were found out, your life would be in jeopardy. So people didn't say anything about it. That was one of the big things that Frederick Douglass wrote about.
Mm-hmm.
When he criticized a guy named Box Brown. There was a fellow named Henry Box Brown who put himself in a box.
Right.
And mailed himself to New York or something like that.
Philadelphia, I think.
Well,
it was Philly, yeah.
And Frederick Douglass was very critical because he said, you just closed another gateway to freedom. And Frederick Douglass was very specific that there were codes that were used, and he never told how he got free. He never wrote about it. And it died with him.
That's really interesting. I never thought about that particular aspect, that he never wrote about how he got free. You're right. He never did.
Yeah, because, you know, he didn't want to close the gate for the next person. I'm convinced, and historians have indicated, that a lot of these people who came through the Eastern Shore came through with the help of black and white watermen, who some of whom were ministers, some who were just against slavery, some of whom had other reasons to help slaves escape. And they would hand them off from one, you know, from one creek and canal to another. Because you can't, the Eastern Shore is just, it's like a, if you imagine a bunch of grapes, that's how the Eastern Shore is. If you imagine just water going between all of those different grapes, that's how the Eastern Shore is. It's
right.
Waterways everywhere.
Everywhere. Have you ever had, what you're talking about right now, and because of this book, Song Yet Sung, have you ever spoken to groups on the Eastern Shore, like the Watermen, the mixed groups on the Eastern Shore, about your book and this and where your ideas came from?
No. No, I will. You know, in October I will.
On the Eastern Shore?
I did meet a Waterman there who's a historian, the son of a Waterman, who was an amateur historian.
Who's that?
I can't recall this guy's name.
Okay.
But he was one of the people who created the walking tour of the Harriet Tubman.
Oh, yes. I know the guy. I know who you're talking about.
Underground Railroad. He's a fascinating guy. He's very smart. McLaughlin or?
Yes.
Is that his name? John McLaughlin?
John McLaughlin, I think that's who it is. And it's the conversation we're having now is a conversation that I think, this is a little digression from your book, but not completely, is a conversation that could be very profound if people on the Eastern Shore, or anywhere else, but let's just say the Eastern Shore for a moment, watermen, farmers, black, white, heard this and wrestled with it together. Do you know, like they had a program here 15 years ago that I was part of where black and white congregations and Jewish and Christians got together and wrestled with Genesis for a year together, cross. You could do that with this book.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, all of my books move toward the commonality of the human spirit. That's where, more or less, where I live creatively. I happen to think that Eastern Shore folks have a very proud and very fascinating history because their web of relationships that existed between them is very close. And I think it would probably help people to understand that they have a shared history with regard to slavery. I mean, the town of Trapp, for example.
Yes, Trapp, T-R-A-P-P-E.
T-R-A-P-P-E.
Right.
I understand that during the Civil War, you had one regiment from Trapp that was shooting against the other regiment because one regiment from Trapp served with the North, and the other regiment served with the South.
This is a divided state all the way around.
Yeah.
Yes.
Listen, if you fight together, you might as well live together.
Right.
So right. I think that's one of the lessons that I got from writing Song Yet Sung, that slavery is our shared legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get, as a black person, once you get past the brutality of slavery, you start to understand and really trust that the relationships that existed during slavery, even though they were founded on something that was very unhealthy, there was some good that came out of it because it forced people to deal with their own morality. And the morality of Americans, and in this case, people on the Eastern Shore, is pretty, pretty, pretty good stuff. I mean, we have pretty good stuff in that regard. We're pretty loaded when it comes to trying to do the right thing. Americans really mostly try to do the right thing.
You're listening to my 2009 interview with author James McBride about his novel, Song Yet Sung. We have to take a very brief break, but there's more of this conversation when we come back. On our way to break, we're hearing Cocaine by Ramblin' Jack Elliott. He was born on this day in 1931, and Ramblin' Jack is one of those men who defined folk music in the 1960s, studied and lived with Woody Guthrie, was a mentor to Arlo Guthrie, still singing to this day, ran off and joined the circus and became a cowboy, came back to Brooklyn, an amazing human being who the last time I saw him at his aging time tried to pick up my wife, the great Ramblin' Jack Elliott. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Smoke in the Water by Deep Purple. Tommy Bolin of Deep Purple was born on this day in 1951. And this morning we're listening to some of our favorite archives from past programs. Let's get right back to my 2009 interview with James McBride, who joins us to talk about his book, Song Yet Sung. Coming back, before we move into your characters a bit more, the idea of the code, I mean, if you posit in this book that there were slaves who did not run but stayed behind, free and not free, just to be able to free their brethren, and it could be as complex as you describe it, from hand signals to bells ringing to quilts to all the rest, that's a pretty profound movement.
Well, you have to remember, if I'm married, you know, to my wife, and my wife is a slave and I'm not, because you had slaves who were married to free people and so forth.
Right, right.
I'm not going to leave until my wife is free and my children. I mean, that was really the dilemma for slaves. You could run off. I mean, masters oftentimes gave slaves money to go to town, you know, bring me a cow and three chickens and get the wagon fixed. And here's, you know, $20. And that would be enough to get you a long way if you were going to run off. But you had to remember that you had your kids there and your wife, and so you would stay. So if I was a slave and my wife were a slave and I were free, I'd be more inclined to try to work out a deal with my master so that I could free her and buy her. And that would take years. And if my master was a good master, if he was a good person, if his word was good, then maybe when I saved up enough money to free her, he would hold to his word. If he was a bad master, he'd just say, well, I'll do that, and then suddenly he dies. And then your wife becomes the property of his son. And then you really have problems. And then you decide to break because you think the son might not hold to his father's word. There were a lot of things. When you have something that's based on this web of relationships, it's flimsy business at times. So there were a lot of reasons why slaves decided to stay. One of them being that maybe you couldn't make it. Or if you got caught, you know, if you got caught harboring slaves, it was really bad business. You really got into a lot of trouble. And that was something that, you know, regardless as to what color you were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can understand why slaves would serve as abolitionists and work on the Underground Railroad. It's much harder to understand why a white person would do it, because white people had nothing to gain. And I think that a lot of these white folks, a lot of these people who walk around now saying that I was, you know, it's sort of like the 60s, like everybody claims they were, you know, marching during the Civil Rights Movement, blah, blah, blah. You know, a lot of blacks weren't even involved in the Civil Rights Movement,
right.
You know. And so the whites who were involved were extremely brave, and the blacks who were involved were just unconsciously brave.
Right.
So I think it's the same way when you talk about slavery. You know, you had people who really, really wanted to be free but didn't want to leave their families, or, in the case of the book, knew that if they left their master would lose everything. Now, in Song Yet Sung, Kathleen Sullivan is very close to her slaves, and so her main slave knows that if he leaves, she's going to lose everything, including his sister and his nephew. I intentionally created that family, you know, in that situation, because both her husband and the husband of her slave, Mary, died on the Chesapeake. They were both watermen.
Right.
One was the master, one was the slave. So these people are already joined at the hip, joined by the death of their respective husbands.
That relationship you built between Mary and Kathleen Sullivan and Wiley and the white kid, Jeff Boy. I mean, it was such a complex, twisted, tied, love-stuck relationship between all of them. And you just, it was amazing. I like the way that both those characters, especially the way Mary and Wiley and Kathleen were really developed characters in this book.
Well, in novels, everything has to be connected, you know.
Right.
In real life, you know, in a novel, in a cheap novel, you know, if you want someone to get lost, you just kill them off. You say, you know, the guy walks in, pow, and the character's dead and so forth.
Right.
That's a pulp novel.
Right, right.
But in a real novel, or literary, so-called literary novel, you know, you have to follow the characters. And these men, the slaves who worked for Kathleen, they respected and loved her. And they loved her children because they raised her children. They helped her raise her children. So when her child gets kidnapped, it, you know, and the kidnapper of their child, the woman, when her child gets kidnapped by the woman, it ratchets the story up a whole nother level. Because now the plans for escaping are, you know, are changed. You can't leave now because the kid is gone, and one of them saw who did it, and he's frightened of the kidnapper.
Right. Right.
And so it's you know, listen, we all talk about, like, if, you know, if I was living, I remember talking to some high school kids, and one of them said, "Man, if I was around when it was slavery, I would just, you know." I would get my gun, and you know, no, you wouldn't. You wouldn't do any of that thing. You would march along until you made decisions based on who you really are deep inside. And that's really what it was.
I keep thinking about it. I'm glad you're coming to the Eastern Shore, because I was one of those civil rights workers who went to jail on the Eastern Shore a number of times in the '60s, and for this book. It just, to me, it would be such an important piece for us here on that Eastern Shore to wrestle with, and just the whole state. It's really, because people need to kind of wrestle with what the real story of slavery is. And speaking of the story of real slavery, two of the characters, talk about Patty Cannon and Liz Spockett, the two people who were, as I understand, both based on real women in that period.
Right. Well, Patty Cannon is based on the real
Patty, a real person, Cannon. Completely. Her character's real.
Yeah, she was real.
Right.
And that was her real name. And she was a gunslinging slave stealer from the Reliance, Maryland area. I believe it was called Reliance back then.
Mm-hmm.
She lived right on the line between Reliance, Maryland and Seaford, Delaware.
Yes, right. Right, exactly.
And her house, her tavern, sat in three different counties, so that any time the authorities from one county would step into one part of it, she'd step into another room, and she'd legally be in another part of in another county, and they couldn't bother her. And her job basically was to steal slaves that were owned by other people, hold them in the basement or attic of her tavern until the boats from New Orleans came up, and then she would sell them cheap to New Orleans slave traders. And once if you were a slave and you were sold to the Deep South, your chances of escape were just about impossible.
You were done, right.
So, she was ruthless. I mean, she killed white people as well. She would kill anyone that got in the way of her business. And she had a gang that she ran with, including her son-in-law. And they were pretty ruthless folks. She makes an appearance in this book, and she is the person who's chasing Liz Spockett, who is based on the character of Harriet Tubman. And Harriet Tubman in real life was, and Liz Spockett has these dreams of the future. And she dreams of what the future is. And when she dreams of the future, she dreams of, like, seeing black men running away from school and sucking giant cigarettes that make their minds stupid and listening to music that preaches murder. She has these dreams. She doesn't know what they mean, but they kind of, they make her into a figure that other black people want to meet. And so at the beginning of the book, she's captured by by Patty Cannon and ends up escaping from Patty Cannon's attic before Patty Cannon can sell her. So the whole book is a chase between these two women, with Liz being chased by Patty and then later being chased by Denwood and Patty, because Denwood is hired by Liz's owner to track her down. And most interestingly, Denwood and Patty Cannon don't like each other either. because he's a waterman who's ambivalent about slavery and has just taken the job, and Patty Cannon makes her living as a slave stealer. So you have all these competing interests who are running after this slave who was very, very good, very clever at eluding them, but is running out of places to hide.
Now, this character Lispocket, the slave who is injured and then is being chased by both Patty Cannon and Denwood, and there's a big piece of the book is the chase, and you don't know what happens. It's a great mystery and gripping mystery in that sense, because you don't know where it's going to end up. And we're not telling folks where it's going to end up. You've got to read the book to find out. But Lispocket, I mean, there's something. This is where the mysticism comes in. There's something very mystical about her, as there was people say about Harriet Tubman, and there was something that she kind of the power of her otherworldliness and the power of her faith and the whole way that faith fits into all this in God is. Talk about it, how you came to that and what that all means for you.
Well, you know, I grew up in the church, and you know, I believe in God, and I believe that God is a very forgiving person who forgives us of our past sins and will forgive the worst sin that you can possibly commit. And so, you know, the people who were involved in slavery, both slave owners and slaves themselves, were always looking for God to help them abscond from their deep, dark sins. And so Liz is a person who, when you read about Harriet Tubman, when you see the pictures of her, you know, she looks like my grandma. You know, she's old and she's sitting there. You know, she doesn't really look like the powerful, young, very vibrant, obviously physically fit and clever woman that she obviously was.
Mm-hmm.
And in real life, Harriet Tubman was struck in the head by not by someone who owned her, but by a white man that she was somehow got involved in a confrontation with when she was 12 years old or so. And because of that, because she got struck in the head, she would black out and fall asleep, you know, at the oddest places. And she often said that when she fell asleep, she would dream. And those dreams would tell her which way to move. The Lord would speak to her in those dreams. And so I imbued that character, that characteristic in the character Liz. And Liz's faith in God is something that she questions constantly when she's running, because she's so traumatized by her experience. And similarly, Denwood's faith in God is something that he constantly questions. He's lost faith in God because he lost his son. And so his faith in God is something that it's constantly brought up to him, this whole business of God is real and God believes in you and so forth. And he, you know, he has to constantly remind people that he doesn't believe in God. But toward the end of his life, he starts to understand that God is real. And Liz has never lost faith in God, but she's lost faith in God's power to help his people. And that faith is revived as the book nears its end, partly because of the woolman character who meets up with
Woolman, yes. I mean, Woolman, if you talk as much as you can about Woolman, in a sense, we also are not going to give anything away here either, but Woolman is the heart of the maroon life. Is an amazing character.
Well, he's the character who really represents the kind of freedom that blacks really wanted, which is that he was a black who was gotten free as a child with his mother and basically lived in the woods, you know, away from everyone. And he's someone that everyone fears. You know, when kids would go to sleep at night, their parents would say, if you don't cooperate, you know, I'm going to get the woolman to come get you. Black folks were afraid of him as well as whites. You know, the rumor was that woolman lived in the forest with his children he had an alligator on a chain and he led him around and so forth. And so he was someone that no one had ever seen, but had heard of. And then Liz mistakenly comes upon the woolman's son who's caught in a trap and frees him. And somehow, by that act, she doesn't exactly earn the trust, but she earns the respect of the woman, who is a physical specimen and as a fighting unit, is no small thing. He was a character who, you know, who knew how to move through the woods, who never messed with anyone, but who was a formidable foe. And so once he's folded into this story, he sort of ratchets it up to the next level.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. An amazing character. I wonder, you know, Miracle of Santa Ana was made into a film, as you know, since you wrote the script, and Spike Lee made the movie. And I'm wondering about this.
Well, Spike wants to make this into a movie, but his concern is that, you know, that people won't fill the seats. I mean, there's a problem. Miracle of St. Anna was a great movie.
Yes, it was.
It was a great movie.
I loved it.
It just didn't get any support from the public or the studio. You know, it was one of Spike's best movies. It was one of the best movies I thought written about World War II. And, you know, it didn't do well. I mean, it came out the same day as one of the debates between Obama and John McCain. And there are a lot of reasons why movies don't do well, but I think Spike wants to make Song Yet Sung into a film.
And you'd have to...
But, you know, you have to raise money to do that, and I don't know that, you know, that's not an easy thing to do.
No, and to do this, to do justice to your book, I mean, and to what this book means, I mean, the movie has to be done in a certain way as well. I mean, it's...
Well, you know, truth be told, I mean, Spike Lee is very open to the characters and what Song Yet Sung is trying to say. You know, he's very sophisticated about
mm-hmm.
how you can't just, you know, wave the sort of the net of blame at white people and say it's your fault and that's the end. I mean, if you seen the movie the Bus, where these guys go to the Million Man March, they
yes,
play out all
right.
these complicated scenarios about race on the bus. It's fascinating. It was a great movie. I think that in terms of working with Spike, I think that Spike is really plugged into what Song Yet Sung is trying to say, but I don't know that... First of all, no other director has ever approached me about doing any of my books as a film.
Really?
That, you know, no other major A-list director. So, and secondly, I think he'd do a great job. I just think he's concerned that, you know, it takes a lot of time to raise the money to get a film going. And I don't know that he doesn't seem to feel that he can do it. He can raise the money to get it done because he's afraid that nobody's going to come see it. And that's what people who you know, that's what investors say, who's going to come see something. As soon as you say slavery, people just go, oh, forget it. You know, they do.
Right, right. No, it's
I mean,
true.
If I see a book about slavery, I'm not interested. Why? I mean, I know what happened, even though that's part of the reason why I wrote this book.
But you don't know what happened, because if you read this book, I mean, it challenges the common notion of what happened and what it was like.
Well, that's one reason why I wrote the book, because I wanted people to see. You know, I love Wild West stories. I love those kinds of
things. You can tell that, right.
And so that's why I wrote this book, so that people could read it and get an idea of what slavery was like, and still, because we get a lot of our history from novels and fiction. And so, you know, that's what he'd have to do to sell it. He'd have to, but you know, in order to sell a book to a movie executive, you got to get the executive to read it. You know, these guys don't read. You know, I hate to say it, they hire people to read.
Right, right.
And, you know,
right.
They got to jump into the jacuzzi or whatever. They don't have time to read books.
Truth be told, I think most people who even do interviews don't read books. It just takes too much time to read.
Yeah, and that means you have to sometimes think and all that. I mean,
oh, no, it's not think.
Well, I shouldn't say that, but I mean, I think that, you know, look, The Color of Water has never been made into a film. And, you know, that's my most famous book.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel bad about that at all. I've been very blessed to be able to make a living as a writer. So if Song Yet Sung never makes it into, you know, into the world as a film, that's fine. I mean, I don't write books to have them made into movies. I wrote this book because God put it in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know anything about the Eastern Shore until I wrote Song Yet Sung. I had never been to the Eastern Shore until I wrote Song Yet Sung.
What were you doing there in the first place?
Well, I was just trolling. You know, I knew that that Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass had lived like 20 or 25 miles from each other.
Right, right.
I knew it was a very beautiful place. And I'd never been there. And I like Maryland. You know, Maryland's, you know, Maryland's close enough to New York that you can just get to it. And once you drive into Maryland, you're in the South.
That's right.
As far as I'm concerned.
Oh, no, I yes, you are. I grew up here. This is the South.
Yeah, so, you know, if you want to go down South, just go to Maryland. You're right there. And then, you know, if you turn around in 4 hours, you're back in New York. And it's, you know, so I just drove down there. You know, I like old crap. I like old cars and tractors and all that old kind of stuff. You can buy a lot of old stuff down there if you want. And, you know, I just started driving down Route 50, and I just enjoyed myself. There was an old secondhand bookstore down there that was pretty good.
Right on the highway, even though I'm right off the highway.
Yeah, it's called the Unicorn.
The Unicorn's a great bookstore.
Yeah, it's a great bookstore. You know, you can't find anything like that in New York anymore, unless you go to the Bronx.
Now, the Strand's not in New York anymore. It's done, it's gone, isn't it?
Yeah, all the good stuff here. Yeah. Manhattan's all tourists now. You know, they're all from Iowa somewhere. but the Eastern Shore, I like it. You know, I like it. I mean, you know, there's definitely some racism there, but, you know, so what? I mean, racism, you know, I'm on 43rd Street. I'm sure there's racism right on this block.
I'm sure there is.
So I just enjoyed it. Once I saw Harriet Tubman's birthplace, I was just fascinated. You know, partly because, you know, you're right near I think it's called the Blackwater Swamp.
Yes, right, Blackwater.
And I went over to the Blackwater Swamp and chatted with some of the people over there at the wildlife refuge, and then I drove down to I think it's called the Hunger River, where the Hooper Island is.
Mm-hmm.
They have two islands: this Upper Island and Lower Island. And I mean, it's just a different world. It's just a different world, and it's cold in the winter, and it's tough, you know. And I started imagining what it must have been like, and obviously, it was really hard for everyone. I was really fascinated with how the oyster business eventually went belly up, you know, partly because the oysters were just, you know, we just dredged the
We dredged them and polluted the Chesapeake Bay on top of it, yep.
Yeah, but also, you know, when big business got involved and started ran the oystermen, the watermen out of business, essentially, by, you know, hiring these gigantic boats with these huge dredges that would just dredge, you know. And so then the individual waterman who would go out on his boat at 4 in the morning and come back at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, was driven out of business by the big boys. It's the same story, however you want to do it, whether it's in 1850 or right now in 2009. It's the same story. The little guy loses and raises a baseball bat that the powers that be used to push us against each other.
James McBride, this is a phenomenal book. I just I appreciate you taking the time with us. James McBride wrote The Song Gets Sung, which is, of course, One Mail and One Book is our book. He's also, of course, the author of these most famous book, The Color of Water, and Miracle at Santa Ana as well. And James McBride, thank you. It's just been so wonderful to talk to you.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate you having me on the show, and I look forward to going to Maryland and eating some fish.
Gotta have some fish. Gotta have some crabs.
Yeah, I have plenty of crab.
Plenty of crabs. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was my 2009 interview with author James McBride. We have to take a very brief break, but when we come back, we'll talk about the critical roles African Americans played during the Revolutionary War, both with the British and with the Americans, as we talk with Alan Gilbert. Stay with us. On the way to break, we hear Smoking Gun by the great Robert Cray, man who's helping to reinvent and put the blues back in the blues, born on this day in 1953.